This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. What will American drug culture look like once the drug war is finally over? With marijuana legalization breaking out all over the country and government approval of once forbidden drugs such as MDMA and psilocybin to treat depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, it's time to start asking that question. Prohibition hasn't just created black markets that are marked by violence, double dealing, and problems with substance purity. It's also distorted how we think about drugs and the social customs and rituals that define their use and promise in our lives. As our pharmacopoeia becomes liberalized, we're going to need to have a better understanding of what sorts of drugs are available, how they work, and how we might best use them to fulfill our hopes and dreams. Nobody is better situated to start this conversation than Hamilton Morris, the 32-year-old host of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia, a show in which he explores drugs as different as PCP, Ambien, ketamine, and psychedelic toads. Morris also does research at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia, in which he and his collaborators create new drugs for testing and research trials. Why are you so interested in drugs?
I need to think of a better answer to that question because I get asked that a lot, and it seems sort of self-evident that they're very interesting. It's like, why would somebody be interested in music or food or something like that? They have an absolutely enormous influence on our culture. People talk about drugs as if it's some kind of niche subculture, but really it encompasses all of medicine. So much of our political landscape is dictated by drug policy. And the prison industrial complex. I mean, it's a huge, huge subject philosophically, medically, scientifically. It's a huge, huge thing.
So it structures everything we do.
Yeah. Once you start seeing the world through that lens, you realize that why wouldn't you be in it? It would be crazy not to be interested in this. It's huge. It's as big as consciousness and our culture. It's enormous.
So one of the things that's interesting, the way that you talk about drugs, and I say this as somebody who's, you know, a kind of cheerful, enthusiastic user of drugs, both legal and illegal, licit and illicit. But, you know, you demythologize them in a way. And like a lot of people who are into drug culture, either drug warriors or kind of celebrators of drugs are like, oh, well, these are magical substances that have superpowers that we can't fully understand, so we have to control them. It seems like you're bringing a different level of conversation to this discussion.
I would hope so, yeah, because I don't think there's any benefit in mythologizing them. I see it in both directions, both positive and negative. Yeah. People dramatically magnify the virtues of certain substances while demonizing others in ways that are totally nonsensical, and it creates this sort of schizophrenic mentality regarding drugs in the United States. You know, sometimes these mythologies are relatively innocuous, whether it's, you know, people starting to think that microdosing psychedelics is going to cure all of society's problems. Probably not, but there's worse things that people could believe. But when it comes to other ideas, like, for example, you know, the crack powder cocaine discrepancy, it can have, you know, major racial, political, criminal implications for people that can really interfere with, you know, can tear apart families, destroy lives.
No, so. Whole societies, communities.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, over the, I've got a few years on you and, you know, it's exciting to witness the beginning of the end of the drug war. I mean, you know, and that's being optimistic, but why do you think things are changing? Why people seem to be more genuinely interested in kind of grappling with drugs and erasing this arbitrary distinction between legal and illegal or licit and illicit? Why is that happening?
It's a good question. I don't know exactly. I do know that in my history of reporting on the subject, which probably started sometime around 2008, 2009, I felt that even then things were a little bit different. You know, I would receive more criticism for not having the same sorts of opinions that were considered orthodox at that time. Even talking about something like methamphetamine lightly was enough to get criticized pretty severely. And there's still subjects like that that you have to stick to a certain line or else you end up getting chastised by the public. But, you know, I think that journalism is largely driven by this swinging pendulum of novelty. And for a long time, it was novel and interesting and engaging to report on how dangerous and horrible and life-destroying drugs are. That was a good story. So somebody pulled their eyes out on PCP, somebody ate their best friend, somebody, you know, set themselves on fire. That's a good story. But then the novelty of scare stories wears off and the pendulum swings in the opposite direction. And then it's more engaging to say, hey, you know, those psilocybin-containing mushrooms, those magic mushrooms that you thought were a drug? Well, it turns out that these guys at Johns Hopkins, they actually think it's a medicine. Isn't that a novel take on all this? It turns out they're actually good. And so that becomes the predominant mode of reporting on the subject. And on that level, which is, I understand, a somewhat cynical interpretation of the media, but I do think that there is a sort of novelty that makes everyone excited to say something different than what they've said in the preceding decades.
What do you think of things like Michael Pollan, the food writer's book a year ago about How to Change Your Mind, which is kind of an NPR imprimatur laden vision of psychedelics? Is that good or bad, or does that advance the conversation about drugs, or does it kind of, is it part of the problem?
Oh, it's absolutely good. Mm-hmm. It's very good. It's almost impressively good. You know, I was amazed by his restraint in writing that book, his complete avoidance of any of the scandalous information, any of the black market history, really, of psychedelics, which is the majority of the history of psychedelics. Most psychedelics that have been consumed haven't been consumed in the context of a psychiatric clinical trial. They've been consumed illegally in an unregulated black market. And to create this extremely palatable, sterile history of psychedelics that is, if you read the book cover to cover, it's very hard for any reasonable person to think psychedelics are bad. He makes a very strong argument for it. So on one level, I think fantastic. You couldn't ask for anything more. On a personal, maybe more pedantic level, I sometimes resent how much emphasis is placed on the clinical use of these things, because I sometimes think that sort of misses the point, that these things should be legal regardless of whether or not they're viable treatments for depression or OCD or anxiety or end of life pain or any of these different things that they do seem very promising for.
Do you think that part of, or we're in a framework, even if we're getting outside of the conventional wisdom of things, it's still, we tend to look at drugs as medicine. And how does that limit the way that we should be kind of experiencing them or talking about them?
Well, I have nothing against thinking of drugs as medicine, because they are. I think that, you know, the distinction between drugs and poisons and medicines is sort of an illusory distinction. We've created all of these different categories that aren't really chemically or pharmacologically meaningful. So I have no objection to talking about drugs as medicines. I just don't want that to be the be-all, end-all of our understanding of this subject. Because what if it turns out that ketamine isn't as valuable a treatment for depression as we think it is in 2019?
But
what if
we want to take it because we like how we feel when we take it.
Is that not valid?
Yeah.
Or then do we go back to a prohibitionist interpretation of these substances if the medical model fails? I mean, I think that there's something a little bit precarious and fragile about the way that we're barking down this path. So I don't want to criticize it, because it's working really well from a political perspective. It's something that people seem to agree with. It's hard to argue against somebody saying, oh, MDMA is a valuable treatment for PTSD suffered by Iraq veterans. How can you argue against that? Say, oh, no, it shouldn't be used. So from that political perspective, it's brilliant. It's extremely effective. But I think from a larger, almost philosophical perspective, it's not the best way to conceptualize drug policy in the United States. Really, it should be about liberty.
You know, individual autonomy, owning your mind.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Timothy Leary in this kind of context? Because he is, you know, in almost all discussions of drugs and certainly hallucinogens and psychedelics, he's a looming figure. Does he get a bad rap because he took it out of the hands of the laboratories and things like that and brought acid to the masses and then kind of went a little bit nuts? You know, what can we learn from his presence in kind of drug culture?
Well, Timothy Leary certainly does get a bad rap, and it became very fashionable to criticize him for a long time and still is today. And I think that that's unfair. I think that it doesn't really acknowledge all of the different factors that were at play at that time. Timothy Leary, of course, was an academic psychologist, and his initial steps in this study of psychedelics were all done academically. But then it became clear that this academic psychiatric model wasn't going to sustain the psychedelic movement. Sandoz, the pharmaceutical company that is now Novartis, withdrew support. You know, they stopped manufacturing LSD sometime around 1965, and that's a big deal. That is the end of any kind of capitalist pharmaceutical support of psychedelics. So after that, there was very little medical support. Then they started making them all illegal. And at that point, it wasn't illogical for Timothy Leary to emphasize this non-medical understanding of psychedelics, because that was the most effective tactic at that time. His strategy was to say, okay, the medical model failed, the psychiatric model failed, the pharmaceutical model failed, so let's go for a religious model. Let's try and protect this use under the First Amendment, and maybe that's the way forward. Well, it turned out that didn't work very well either. And now he's criticized horribly for, you know, ruining medical, scientific, academic research with psychedelics. But he was there at the beginning. He tried. There were many factors that contributed to the disintegration of that research. I think it was inevitable. And I think to blame Timothy Leary for being enthusiastic or a zealot is sort of unfair. You know, you wouldn't blame somebody who's enthusiastic about alcohol for, you know, alcohol prohibition if it occurred. It's not fair. We should live in a society where people can be enthusiastic about something. The real issue is that the drug policy was in such a precarious position that one zealot could have such a major impact.
Do you think, though, to go back to our earlier conversation about kind of mythologizing, did he oversell the virtues of drugs? Perhaps.
That's an interesting question. I happen to also believe that psychedelics are truly amazing substances. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at the way that he talked about them at that time, I think that there's a little bit of a certain kind of pseudoscientific wackiness that mm-hmm. I don't agree with. But I think his awe is valid. Mm-hmm. I think that he really did see this potential in them. And I can't fault him for that. I can't fault him for his enthusiasm.
One of the most memorable episodes of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia is an episode about PCP. And it's titled A Positive PCP Story, where you offer up, you know, a positive version of PCP. Summarize that episode, and also comment on the mischaracterization or the demonization of PCP as kind of a shorthand for dumb ways that we talk about drugs. What's going on in that episode, and what can we learn from the counter narrative that you present?
Yeah, that episode was actually how I started making the TV show, because at the time when this television network, Viceland, was mm-hmm. beginning, I had proposed making a new version of a TV show or an online TV show that I'd been making for several years previously. And one of the executives said, oh, well, we already have this tentative show, and it's about all these, you know, crazy drug stories, and, you know, PCP, it's crazy, and this drug Bromo Dragonfly, it kills people, it's crazy, let's do this, let's talk about the world's craziest right. drugs. And I thought, no, that's, first of all, the stories were old, they were bad, it was poorly conceived. But I said, you know, this is just a stupid way of going about this. It's been done. It's not even interesting. Why not do something original? Why not talk about how these things are actually beneficial and not just the ones that are, you know, undergoing some kind of clinical scientific validation, but the ones that are still considered black market commodities or are black market commodities? And he was saying, well, you know, there's some drugs that are bad. You have to acknowledge. You can't say that something like PCP is good. And I said, well, sure you can. Of course you can. Of course you can. And he said, well, if you can tell me a story about how PCP isn't bad, then we'll do that. And so that was the pilot for Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. And, you know, I think the PCP is a perfect example of a drug that was demonized by virtually everyone in and outside of the drug community. It got to the point where it was shorthand for a bad experience. If you had something negative happen to you, you'd talk about it like, oh, there must have been PCP in it. And the same way that people would
It's laced with PCP.
Or the same way they blame strychnine for things. Yeah. It just became the explanation for badness. Right. And really, it's a perfect example of a substance that's been totally mischaracterized because, you know, when used carefully under controlled circumstances, it's no worse than anything else. Pretty much every drug has the potential to be extremely dangerous under certain circumstances. If you were to, you know, people die from caffeine overdoses. Mm-hmm. It happens. If you have access to pure caffeine and you use it recklessly, you can get into trouble with it. And so what happens with PCP is the way that it's used tends to be unregulated, people consume too much of it. There isn't an environment of any kind of harm reductionist drug education that helps people use the substance responsibly. And so, you know, there are problems.
You're careful to avoid kind of moral terms, like bad, you know, there are no bad drugs. It's you're like a Catholic priest in a 1930s movie. There are no bad boys, right? Only bad. But Are there certain substances or, you know, that are actually just toxic? Or is it always the dose makes the poison or the dose makes the positive side of the drug?
Oh, there certainly are substances that are so toxic that they have no value as a, you know, recreational intoxicant, you know, and most of those things people don't use anyway, really. You know, they're obscure things like, you know, perichloroamphetamine or something like that. Most people haven't heard of that, but in fact, the use of it has been primarily psychiatric. But there are things that are dangerous, and there are things that are not well suited to street use, like fentanyl, because it's not that fentanyl is a bad drug. In fact, it's a fantastic drug as a surgical.
It's a wonder drug.
And you know, a lot of brilliant people spent their lives designing that substance. Mm-hmm. It's a really amazing thing that we should be grateful for. But if you use it without measuring the dose, it can be extremely dangerous. And on top of that, I don't think it's what most people want to begin with because it has a very short duration. It's too easy to overdose on it. Most people don't want fentanyl. It's something that is used deceptively to increase the potency of things that are, you know, misrepresented as heroin. And again, that's something that emerges out of the black market.
Right. What are the things that might propel a kind of broad-based both legalization, changes in drug policy, but also kind of a change in our mental attitudes towards drugs? What are the types of events or activities that might move that forward? And then what are the events that would set it back?
You know, I think that just basic education is a really crucial thing. You know, it's amazing to me how many people have absolutely no concept of dosage. It just doesn't exist in their mind. And again, that part of that has to do with the black market. So you buy LSD, it's on blotter paper. People say that it contains 100 micrograms per dose, but they don't know. They have no idea how much they're taking. So they don't know the dose of what they're consuming. That already puts them at a disadvantage to be able to critically evaluate what they've done. If you know exactly how much you've taken, you can then respond accordingly and say, well, that last time I took 80 micrograms, I was actually pretty strong. That was a little bit uncomfortable. Next time I'm going to take 70 micrograms of LSD. I think that's a better dose for me. And then you have a more constructive, informed relationship with the substance. But people can't make that sort of assessment in a black market economy because they don't know what they're taking. They don't know the dose. And so anything that people can do to put themselves in an informed position where they're using things responsibly, understanding the dose, understanding the identity of the materials that they're consuming, I think that that's like maybe the most important thing possible. But then, you know, doing what you can to learn about basic chemistry and pharmacology, I think that also helps a lot.
Do you see something like the way the opioid crisis is being discussed? I mean, first off, do we have an opioid crisis? And then is that something that is going to slow down, kind of move into a post-prohibition era? Or is it actually something that might end up propelling us there faster?
It's a complicated question because certainly people have argued that, you know, liberalization of cannabis law could represent a solution to problems associated with the use of opioids.
Meaning that people would be smoking pot rather than taking heroin or what they
exactly
think is an opioid.
Yeah. And I think that probably is true because there's a number of people that for whatever reason, they probably really need to or want to be intoxicated. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how can you do that in the least damaging way possible? In the same way that there's a lot of people out there that want some stimulant in the morning when they wake up. Like, you know, and caffeine happens to be a fantastic substance because it gives you that stimulation in the morning, but it doesn't produce there is a withdrawal if you consume a lot of it and you stop suddenly. But for the most part, it's a pretty amazing substance. And so you want to look for things like caffeine. And cannabis, I think, is almost like that in that it's not a perfect substance. There are people that do develop problematic relationships with it. But relative to alcohol, and certainly relative to the stronger opioids, it allows people to maybe cope with their pain, relax at the end of the day without dramatically damaging their body or their social and professional functioning.
What are we getting wrong when we talk about an opioid crisis?
Well, I don't even, you know, the word that people typically use isn't crisis, it's epidemic.
Right.
And I don't like that term. I think that there's a lot of problems with it. One is that it has this, it places the emphasis on the drug and treats the drug like a disease, which it is not. So if people talk about the vaping epidemic, the Juul epidemic, well, how does that exist? When you talk about it that way, you think, oh, maybe if I'm on the bus and there's someone next to me and they've got a Juul, maybe I'll catch the Juul addiction.
Right.
It's part of the Juul epidemic. But that's not the way drug addiction actually functions. People, as uncomfortable as it is to say, people do need to take some responsibility for their own behaviors, mm-hmm. and they need to educate themselves. And it's not as simple as like a substance attacking people indiscriminately, and they have no control whatsoever in these epidemics. So I think that the way that the opioid situation has been described has been very, it's shifted blame really onto one small group of people, the Sackler family. Mm-hmm. And we're going to say, okay, it's cackling Mortimer Sackler counting his blood money, or he's dead. So in the grave, yep. counting his blood money. And he's the whole cause of all this. And no one else knew. The doctors didn't know because right. they were so hypnotized by his brilliant advertising campaign and the way that he infiltrated medical education that no one ever knew that opioids were addictive. And of course, the patients didn't know either. But I don't think that's the case. I think, in fact, everyone knew. I think the Sacklers knew. I think the doctors knew. I think the distributors knew. And I think in many instances, probably most instances, the patients knew. Mm-hmm. And so instead of creating this situation where we all pretend that nobody understood anything, why don't we acknowledge the truth that we actually did know and that almost everyone played a knowing part in this phenomenon, take responsibility for what happened, and everyone should try to conduct themselves more constructively in the future and create a support network for the people that do develop problematic relationships with opioids, whether it's in giving them agonist replacement therapy in the form of buprenorphine or methadone or whatever it is they might choose, or, you know, simply helping them with some other form of rehabilitation where they can stop using the drugs if they want to.
Did you have any, when you were a kid in school, did you go through any drug education programs?
Sure. Yeah. I went through DARE.
Yeah. What are your memories of that?
My memories are that it was absurd and it was, you know, funny and counterintuitive, and that it certainly created interest in drugs. You know, and it was, if I remember correctly, I think it was very dated as well. You know, they're teaching people about, you know, the dangers of barbiturates and things mm-hmm. like that when these things are just essentially yeah. not on the market, or talking about PCP or LSD. You know, yeah. At this time, I'd never even met anyone who in my age group right. that had used LSD. So it was sort of informing me about them in a way that piqued my curiosity, because I could tell that it was bullshit, mm-hmm. but didn't make any effective argument for why they shouldn't be used.
Mm-hmm. You create your own drugs for research purposes.
Yes.
What is the decision tree on that? How do you decide, well, I want to try and synthesize this or a variation of this drug? How do you go about figuring out what to do?
Well, it's investigational. So you take, typically there's a lead compound, a known compound of one sort or another, depending on what I am researching. And along with this chemist that I work with, Jason mm-hmm. Wallach, will modify the structure in various ways that we think might be pharmacologically interesting, and then submit them for screening. And I think that's the way most medicinal chemistry functions. Mm-hmm. You know, you make informed guesses, but you don't really.
So what's an example? You've played around with Ambien, right?
Yes, recently I've been looking at.
And why is Ambien a good drug to kind of improve or restructure?
Well, Ambien is, you know, from a pharmaceutical perspective, it's an immensely successful, profitable, and effective substance, but it mm-hmm. also has all these psychiatric side effects. And the nature of those side effects are not pharmacologically understood. You'd think that something as big as mm-hmm. Ambien delirium, we must have an explanation for it, but we don't. So it's been interesting to look at various structural modifications of the zolpidem molecule mm-hmm. and see how that might change its mm-hmm. binding at its site of action, which is the GABA-A receptor, although we haven't even started the pharmacological screening on that. This is just pure chemistry at this point.
I mean, it's a powerful drug, and if you can make it so that it's more effective with less side effects, that's a good thing.
And this isn't even clinical. This is just, you know, this is simply, you know, molecular neuropharmacology, just kind of trying to even this is all in vitro, by the way. So this is like just trying to understand the most basic elements of how these things function and how different modifications of the structure might change the way that it behaves in the brain.
What is the best thing that you've made and what is the worst?
Best and worst. I mean, there's things that have interesting pharmacologies, but I don't know that I can make that kind of a assessment because it's not based on the qualitative effects because that's not the nature of the research. It's based on the binding at different subtypes of receptors. So it's, you know, best in that case might be high selectivity for a certain receptor like 5-HT1A or something like that.
Are you optimistic or do you think that we're going to get into a more and more kind of individualized biochemistry or so that you will essentially be making drugs for individual people based on their chemistry and like a kind of personalized molecular drug taking?
That's an interesting question. I think even with things like 23andMe, there is increased appreciation of the metabolic biochemical differences between people. You know, certain people have higher levels of this or that catabolic enzyme, and that does play a role in response to various pharmacotherapies. I don't know if we're at a level yet, at a place where we can individually tailor pharmaceuticals to people's needs. I think it would be really interesting if it were possible. Maybe.
Has studying drug, you know, pharmacology and kind of drug issues, has that changed your mind on other issues?
I would say a little bit. Yes, it has. And one of them that I'm still a little bit uncomfortable with, but one is maybe gun control on some level, because I often encounter this belief in the realm of drugs where people will say, well, I don't smoke cannabis, so why would I want cannabis to be legal? Or, you know, or you see someone who's straight will say, well, I'm not gay, so why should gay people get to marry? I'm not gay. And then I of course recognize why that is a stupid and lacking compassion and a horrible way to conduct yourself. And then I think about guns and I think, well, I maybe fall into that same category in terms of, I don't use guns. I don't like guns. Why should anyone be allowed to have guns? I think guns are stupid. And so I think that maybe encountering those same sorts of debates in the realm of drugs has made me think more carefully and critically about the things that I'm against and not having a knee-jerk reaction to assuming that they should be prohibited just because I don't like them.
There are two seasons of Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia in the, you know, that are archived online and available. A third season's coming up. What will be different about the third season, or what drugs will you be investigating?
Well, assuming that it happens, this is not certain at the moment, but there are a number of different things that I want to investigate. You know, I've been interested in doing something about methamphetamine chemistry for a long time. LSD chemistry is something that's pretty fascinating. Something about the tradition surrounding ibogaine in Central Africa. There's a lot of fun projects that I think would be really interesting to explore. So I do hope that I can get back to filming soon.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. We've been talking with Hamilton Morris. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Google, at Apple, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, and at Reason.com. Thanks for listening.